So our opening words this morning come to us from our old friend, Ralph Waldo Emerson. The ground of hope is in the infinity of the world, which infinity reappears in every particle, the powers of all society in every individual, and of all mind in every mind. I know against all appearances that the universe can receive no detriment, that there is a remedy for every wrong and a satisfaction for every soul. Here is this wonderful thought. But whence came it? Who put it in the mind? It was not I, it was not you. It is elemental, belongs to thought and virtue. And whenever we have either, we see the beams of this light. Okay, let's have some fun. Let's imagine for a moment that the room around us here is alive, that these walls have memories, that this floor pushes back up against your feet at every step, and that each chair is its own being, cradling you with warm intent, and that the air and light travel with purpose to fill your lungs and your eyes. And that all of these elements are active participants in the reality of this room, along with the ostensibly more conscious and important participants, which is to say, us. And we walk outside and we encounter a living sky and earth filled with living beings, our relatives, who are deep in conversations that we can hear if we pay attention. The slow voice of the mountains, the dancing feet of the clouds sounding on the air, the singing of the green leaves as they follow the sun. Such an idea would have been, and still is, a basic understanding of how the world works to indigenous peoples, and to most of our ancient ancestors as well, no matter where they came from, because all of them were immersed in what we now call nature, and were deeply dependent on the generosity of the web of life. And because they saw the other beings in the web of life as having dignity and being worthy of respect, they treated them that way. There's a story, perhaps apocryphal, that when Western biologists first went exploring in the Amazonian rainforest, they asked the local shamans about their use of medicinal plants, information that the shamans were then happy to share. And then when they asked them how they came by this knowledge, the shaman said, well, we took this one plant, psychoactive, and we communed with the other plants, and they told us. And so a great deal of what the plants told the shamans actually turned out to be true. But there was a deeply felt reciprocity with the generosity of the natural world. Never take too much, so that the world could regenerate and the people and all the beings could thrive. Because other beings, those other plants and animals, were seen as being equally entitled to that generosity. And although we're told not to anthropomorphize these beings, I say, go ahead. These relationships are personal. These are our cousins, after all. A few years ago, biologists began taking a look at what really goes on in forests, and what looked like a whole bunch of individual trees competing for light and resources are actually complex communities that trade information and nutrients underground. Trees of the same species growing close together will fuse their roots and exchange materials. Seedlings of different species share nutrients via the symbiotic fungi that grow alongside and between the tree roots. And together, the trees and the fungi and the other organisms co-create a stable, healthy forest that none of them could do on their own. And we're also learning that our bodies and our health depend on billions of bacteria that line our skin and our guts and cover our skin. And that without them, we would not be alive. We're more like a colony organism. And we co-create our existence with these beings. And so as we begin to understand all this, I think we have to ask, how does this inform our spiritual experiences and our understanding of religion? For a long time, a couple of different ideas have informed the way we understand these things. And the first of these is called the perennial philosophy, which underpinned a great deal of religious thinking in the 18th and 19th centuries and heavily influenced the Unitarians and, guess who, the Transcendentalists. It's a philosophy whose influence we still feel deeply today. Now, perennialism envisions a single pre-existing spiritual ultimate which can be directly known through our individual spiritual experience. Right? Following me? And so this knowing provides us with direct access to things as they really are, the ultimate nature of reality, and our innermost identity. And central to this view is the idea that once we lift the manifold veils of cultural distortions and doctrinal beliefs and our ego projections, our sense of separate existence, and so forth, the doors of perception are unlocked and the true nature of self and reality is revealed to us in liberating insight. And so in the classic perennialist view, every spiritual tradition leads to this identical single ultimate. They're like different paths to the top of the same mountain. I think we're all familiar with that metaphor. And we're all getting to the same place. We're just doing it in different ways, so that a certain amount of universalist sentiment and camaraderie is possible with other people and traditions. Another possibility that arises from this view is that each religion is only seeing one aspect of the ultimate, and so has an authentic but limited perception of divine reality. We're only seeing one little piece of it, our own little piece of the truth. And ultimately, this requires sort of this syncretic fusion to a complete understanding of this ultimate, as well as figuring out the path to salvation or spiritual enlightenment. So far, so good? So this kind of leads us to that old folktale about the blind man and the elephant, right? Each of whom thought the elephant was like different things. It was like a snake and a tree and a rope and a wall. And none of them agree, so they start fighting. And the second idea is that our spiritual experiences, these spiritual phenomena, are individual inner experiences. Basically, that it's all in our heads, right? I'm just experiencing this in my own little consciousness. And they're experienced by each of us alone, and they don't really have any external validity. So what if all of this is wrong? A few years ago, I encountered the work of a transpersonal psychologist named Jorge Ferrer, whose ideas kind of blew my mind and actually transformed my thinking on this subject. And the short version of this is, no pre-given, pre-existing, ultimate spiritual reality exists. And that different spiritual ultimates can be enacted through intentional or spontaneous co-creative participation in the spiritual power of the mystery. And the key, one of the key phrases here is different spiritual ultimates. Because we aren't all trying to get to the top of the same mountain, because there is no mountain. There's only this indeterminate and dynamic mystery that has no pre-given ultimate state to be revealed. And the other key word is enact. The various traditions lead to the enactment of these ultimates, of these liberations, of these revelations about the divine mystery. And although these spiritual ultimates may share some qualities, they are actually independent religious aims. And so they share similar attributes, but we can't really conflate them. What they generally share, though, is the intention of leading the participant away from self-centeredness to larger and larger circles of awareness and concern, a liberation from limiting perspectives and understandings. Ferrer uses the metaphor of an ocean, what he calls the ocean of emancipation. And the ocean of emancipation has many shores, if you will. And the enacting of different spiritual insights and ultimates requires specific mystical teachings, trainings, and practices. So we might say that particular rafts are needed to arrive at particular spiritual shores. If you want to reach the shore of nirvana, you need the raft of the Buddhist Dharma. The Catholic raft, or perhaps the Catholic ocean liner, takes you to the Catholic shore. If you want to realize the knowledge of Brahman, you follow the path of Vedic study and meditation, and not the practices of Tantric Buddhism, devotional Sufism, or psychedelic shamanism. And these enactments are not just in our heads. Spiritual knowing is not a mental representation of a pre-given independent spiritual object, but it's an enacting. It's a bringing forth of a world or domain co-created by the different elements involved in that participatory event. And so some of those elements include songs and rituals, sacred objects, sacred texts, sacred places, individual intentions and dispositions, the various cultural and religious frameworks that we bring to this, the other beings involved in that, and most importantly, this dynamic and indeterminate spiritual power of inexhaustible creativity that we call the mystery. And so the participatory nature of spiritual knowing refers to the role that our individual consciousness plays during most spiritual and transpersonal events. And this relationship is not one of appropriation or possession or passive representation of knowledge, but of communion and co-creative participation. Enacting, bringing into being together, just as the forest, just as our bodies and their symbionts. And this kind of knowing, this participatory knowing, is transformative in at least the two following senses. First, participation in a spiritual event, participation in a spiritual event brings forth the transformation of self and world. And second, a transformation of self is usually necessary to be able to participate in spiritual knowing. And this knowing, in turn, draws forth the self through its transformative process. We can't engage in spiritual activity without being transformed, basically. And for those of us who see our daily lives and our experiences as some expression of the spiritual, there's little division between ordinary experience and spiritual experience. And from that perspective, all experiences are spiritual experiences and involve all the senses and the mind and the body and everyone and everything involved in the experience. Although the metaphor of an ocean is helpful to illustrate this variety of spiritual ultimates, it's ultimately inadequate to convey the participatory and inactive nature of this kind of spiritual knowing. Because with all geographical metaphors, you can easily get the mistaken expression that these shores are pre-given, that they're somehow waiting out there to be reached or discovered, that the Catholic shore was out there before there were Catholics, that the Buddhist shore was out there before there were Buddhists. That catapults us back into this perspectival perennialism, right back to the story of the blind man and the elephant. These spiritual ultimates are brought into being through enactment in a participatory relationship with the world. And they did not exist before, and they will cease to be when they are no longer enacted. So in this participatory view, our spirituality is developed and revealed primarily in relationship with other beings and things and places and ideas. If you regard spirituality as primarily the fruit of your individual practice, or an individual practice such as meditation, then you can have this gross anomaly of a spiritual person who is an interpersonal oppressor, or the possibility of spiritual traditions that are oppression prone. But if you regard spirituality as centrally about liberating relationships, then a new vista of participative religion opens up, and this calls for a radical restructuring and reappraisal of traditional spiritual maps and routes. Ferrer argues that our goal can never be simply the recovery of or reproduction of some past sense of the sacred. We cannot ignore that most religious traditions are beset not only by intolerant, exclusivist, and absolutist tendencies, but also by patriarchy, authoritarianism, dogmatism, conservatism, transcendentalism, I'm quoting him here, body denial, sexual repression, and hierarchical institutions. And put more bluntly, the contemplative traditions of the past have too often functioned as elaborate and sacralized techniques for dissociating our consciousness from brutal social realities. It is, after all, relatively easy to be emancipated from the world or to become one with a deity or ontological absolute and leave all the world's grossly unjust social structures and practices comfortably in place. Racism, gender injustice, homophobia, religious bigotry, colonialism, the list goes on and on. A perennialist ultimate reality that locates all real truth in the one is now superseded by a world in which the real reveals itself not in the Savior or the sacred text or in an ultimate reality, but in radical relation and the sacred present. Our religious life cannot be about returning to some golden age of scripture or metaphysical absolute. It is about co-creating new revelations in the present, in critical interaction with the past. And such a practice is dynamic, uncertain, and yet carries hope for a Tikkun-like theurgical healing of the world. The metaphor of an ocean of emancipation is also problematic, because if traditional spiritual paths first defined that which they liberate from, then those enacted spiritual ultimates may actually be less liberating than we think. From modern perspectives, what most of the religious traditions have meant by emancipation or salvation is not at all what we would like to imply by those terms today. So a more useful term than emancipation or liberation, which are always an emancipation or liberation from something, might be that of transformation. Transformation into. If our spiritual realities are co-creative enactments, what matters is not who has the truth, or what set of systems or beliefs come closest to it, but how cooperatively and creatively we act together in enacting a just and sustainable world. There's an ocean of transformation that awaits us, and we can't do it alone. We can't navigate it alone. The participatory vision also reframes our relationship with the divine from that of children or subordinates to a father, mother, higher power, to individuated adult beings in relationship with the mystery. And since the mystery is indeterminate, no individual or group or system of belief may claim authority over others in the name of the mystery. The top-down authoritarian model of divinity is replaced by a more equal partnership with the divine and a co-equal redistribution of creative power. Sacred immanence, wholeness, and relationship are central to this participatory vision. And so our universalism is thus revealed as a dynamic process that we share in and with the mystery. Universalism is still present, but it's no longer seen as the highest expression of the one, but rather as existing in dynamic relationship with pluralism, as a deep and ongoing interplay among the many. This phenomenal world is now seen as an innovative process of being and becoming, not a place to be liberated from. And this dance reveals an endless, endless creative power, seeking to more fully manifest and embody all forms of being and knowing, subject and object, love and wisdom, through intimate dialogue and communion. In the Mountains and Rivers Sutra, Zen Master Dogen wrote, "The appearance of the mountains is completely different when we are in the world, gazing at the distant mountains, and when we are in the mountains, meeting the mountains." John Daido Lori Roshi has this to say about those lines. "The nature of the mountain is completely different when we have separated ourselves from it as observers, and when we are the mountain with whole body and mind." When we are intimate with something, it no longer exists, and we no longer exist. There is no way to talk about it, to judge it, to analyze it, or categorize it. It fills the whole universe. In closing, I'll leave you these words. Intimacy, communion, co-creation, and transformation. May it be so. Thank you.